This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with an airport planner who also happens to have co-founded an organization for innovation in aviation. In the news, we look at a very old paper travel voucher and how the airline reacted when it surfaced. A study of bacteria and fungus in the terminal and on aircraft, expensive refrigerators for Air Force One, and a donation by 9 airlines to the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. We have an Across the Pond segment from Peter Johnson that looks at BA and their latest change to the passenger experience in short-haul flights. Peter then reflects on the Qantas challenge to Airbus and Boeing on the Kangaroo route. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 489 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is first, Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's a flight instructor and he publishes the Jetwine blog.
Hey, good evening. It's Chicago and we didn't win the Super Bowl last night, but it's okay.
Yeah, there's always next year, right?
Oh, sure.
Well, speaking about Super Bowl winners, we're also joined by David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian, and also a Philly resident.
Yeah, years upon years of suffering through the Eagles. They pulled it out yesterday, and my town is ecstatic and electrifying. It is kind of impressive to see everybody in work coming in wearing Eagle shirts, and everybody was in a good mood today. And despite the press, we really didn't trash the city last night, and everybody was well behaved and looking forward to the parade on Thursday. And it's a good week. 2018 is going to be a good year. I mean, if the Eagles won the Super Bowl, but more to the point, the Eagles won it by beating Tom Brady and the Pats.
Yes, they did. And they should be congratulated. And it was a good game, too. Not all Super Bowl games are good spectating games, but this one certainly was.
Highest scoring game in NFL history.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Brady threw the most yards of anybody in Super Bowl history and lost.
That's right.
That's a great stat.
Yeah, it is. All right. Well, also joining us from the West Coast is Brian Coleman, our associate producer. Hey, Brian.
Congratulations, David, Philadelphia, and all that. Hi, Rob. I was also kind of happy to see Brady drop that one pass, so I'll probably get a bunch of hate mail for that. But I,
you might.
Of the quarterbacks catching footballs, Philadelphia was able to
Foles
execute.
Was much better at it than Brady.
Yeah. No, it was definitely a great game, and hopefully kept everyone's interest till the very last play of the game.
It sure did. Well, our other co-host, Max Trescott, is off this episode. He's up in the air somewhere flying a client around, so we'll look for him next week. Our guest this episode is Chris Groh. He's an airport planner, and he works with airports across the country. Chris also co-founded an organization for innovation in aviation called Runway.VC. He hosts his own podcast about the future of aviation. And he also works at Cutchins and Groh. Chris is an Airplane Geeks listener, and he's on our Slack team. Chris, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Thanks, Max, and congratulations again, David. As a beloved New Orleans Saints fan, last year I did want to see the Patriots win, but this year I was happy to see the Eagles take home their first Super Bowl, so good job to them.
There you go. Now, Chris, you work with airports, I guess, of all sizes, but your specialty is with general aviation airports, and even more specifically, smaller general aviation airports. What is it about the smaller or just general aviation airports in general that is kind of appealing to you?
Yeah, that's right. So it's general aviation airports for me are, there's almost a romance behind them. I think one of the reasons why I was rooting for the Eagles last night as well, because they always seem to be the underdog in the world of aviation. They tend not to get as much press or newsworthy incidences when things go right. You know, you never want to see newsworthy when things go bad, but they're never grabbing headlines for good things. And they are just as important, if not more important from a historical standpoint to aviation than commercial service airports are.
Well, we're going to talk more about what it means to be an airport planner coming up, but we're going to start out with a little bit of the aviation news from the past week. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Ready from Philadelphia.
Our first item, well, this is a late addition to the lineup here. This is from Aviation Week. Boeing unveils 737-7, smallest MAX variant. And I think just today, Brian, didn't that happen today where Boeing rolled out the Dash 7, the tiniest MAX variant?
Yeah, they sure did. And this aircraft has always confused me, and it seems to be confusing the buyers as well. Or, well, I guess they're not very confused over it because they're just not buying it. I don't see much of a place for this. It's nice to see Boeing, though, make progress with the MAX product line, but they sure don't have very many orders for the 7.
No, I think less than 70 orders. Now, they're hoping to start test flights soon and deliver the first Dash 7 next year in 2019. I guess kind of a competitor for the A319. Boeing says that this one holds a few more passengers, has a little bit greater range. And interestingly enough, it's got the longest range of any of the 737 MAX aircraft.
Yeah, but I think besides the type commonality, the C-Series really, I think, has a lot of advantages over this aircraft. And that's why I just don't see it really having a place in the market. So I know I might have to defer to Rob over any other economics for the aircraft.
Yeah, you know, I don't think I can really give you a good feel on this one because I honestly never thought we'd see this thing get this far with the C-Series being close. And I don't know, I wondered, you know, weeks and weeks ago when Boeing got really hot about the C-Series and the penalties for importing them to give to Delta. I wondered if it had something to do with the poor old 737 7 MAX. And I don't know. They do seem awfully close to me.
Yeah, quite often I think the smallest variant in a family of airliners tends not to be the biggest seller. I mean, I'm thinking of the Airbus 318, for example. A lot of times the economics on the smaller variants just don't work out as well for the airlines. Again, there needs to be a matching of that economics and the route that they're flying. There's not a lot of orders for this one. You know, maybe that'll change in the future.
Yeah, one of the other stories that I was reading was talking about where they really see a place for this aircraft is with the military and the BBJ market. And I don't know, maybe that might be true. If you need to carry not that many passengers for a really long distance and still maintain that common type rating, I don't know, it could very well fit in there.
But it's also a huge cabin. I mean, that's what would make it attractive to business people. Mm-hmm. I mean, remember that the width of that cabin down there at NBAA? I mean, that's a pretty big big airplane, Brian.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and that's what I was thinking. It'd be perfect for that. Or again, even in military use, transporting 100 and some people, it seems like it could do that efficiently.
We should suggest that to the White House.
Yeah,
they want to do for infrastructure. This could be military add-ons and all that sort of thing.
Oh, right. I think Janet jets would be the perfect use for these. Flying these into Area 51 and Area 52.
Just about the right size.
With this kind of things, every time I see, whether it's Boeing or Airbus or even Bombardier, kind of experimenting with aircrafts and people saying, well, there's no real market for it now. I'm almost wondering if it's just a test balloon that they're kind of putting up for future development down the line. I can't imagine that they don't have like 20-year strategies for these types of aircraft. And as you're seeing, especially with Airbus and Bombardier and Boeing, both of them are, they're not quiet about it anymore. They're not making a whole lot of press about it either, but they are doing some experimenting with alternative fuel as well as, you know, hybrid technology. So I'm wondering if they're trying to figure out the technology to stretch energy usage out of these types of aircraft that will then lead into development of technology down the line.
Yeah, interesting, Chris. Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right that large corporations like this, like Boeing and Airbus and others, they don't just say, well, I don't know, let's make one this size and see what happens. I mean, it's all usually part of a thought-out strategy and plan, which, of course, yeah, is usually not particularly public. Sometimes it's obvious, but other times it's not.
And they can make bad bets, right?
Sure.
The A380 is a perfect example of that. But nonetheless, you know, I think, Rob, you made a point of the fit they threw against Bombardier with the C series. And I always saw that when they first announced that, I knew that that wasn't a direct attack at Delta as much as it was they're trying to just cut the head off the snake as Bombardier creeped into bigger aircraft. And I think they were not anticipating the partnership between Airbus and Bombardier. But then, you know, a couple weeks later, Airbus announces that they're partnering with Rolls-Royce and Siemens to develop their own hybrid engine while Boeing invests in Zunum. So, and I think it all is, it's all going to point towards that market at the end of the day.
All right. Well, we have an item from Inc.com. A United Airlines passenger found a forever travel voucher from 1998. Here's how United responded. John Walker apparently booked a United Airlines flight from Nashville to Sacramento 20 years ago, but he wasn't able to go. And recently, he discovered the $378 printed ticket voucher dated December 31st, 1998. Rob, what happened next is, it's kind of interesting.
Well, it's about par for the course for United. Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute. No, it's not. The people at United actually did, as Brian often calls it, the right thing. And they decided to honor this man's ticket. And they gave him a pass that would get him. I forgot where he was going. Brian, I don't know if you saw that story. Did it give a destination, or was it good almost anywhere in the States?
No, wasn't this, I read another story where they gave him not the dollar value of the original voucher, but they prorated it for, or adjusted it to today's dollars. So he actually got more money than the value of the ticket. And that's why I was going to put it in the positive airline story of the week, but it made it into the news. So now, I mean, really, United stepped up and I truly believe did the right thing here. Yeah.
Well, I had to put it in our news because United doesn't make good news very often. And I was just, I was stunned when I saw it. But it was nice. It was nice.
It was very nice. And we should be clear that United was under no obligation to honor this if for no other reason than the bankruptcy they went through in 2010.
Yeah, that certainly canceled all their debts, that's for sure. And this would have been considered a debt.
Yeah, sure. Nice story. Another story that's, well, kind of maybe not so nice from the LA Times. Germs in airplane cabins are bad, but it's even worse at the airport terminal. So the insurancequotes.com site has a report, Germs at the Airport. And they say that they, quote, conducted 18 tests across 6 surfaces from 3 major U.S. airports and airline flights. They say, we sent our swabs to the lab and found the average number of viable bacteria and fungal cells per square inch. That's apparently called colony-forming units, or CFUs. Looking to see how clean traveling really is. The worst on board the airplane location was, as you might think, the flush button on the airline on the airplane toilets. That was a little over 95,000 CFUs, right? Colony forming units. The tray tables had 11,595, and the seat buckles had 1,116. But that wasn't the worst part. What they found at the airport was kind of amazing.
How were the germs dressed? I mean, is that how they recognize them, or?
Yeah, that's it's the old swab and culture. The worst offenders, or the most CFUs, were found, guess where, at those airport kiosk screens with 253,857 CFUs.
Yeah, they are just germ magnets, aren't they?
That's really amazing. I'm kind of surprised it's that much higher than the airplane flush buttons. They also looked at the bench armrests, 21,630 CFUs. The drinking fountain buttons, 19,181. Now, just to put it in perspective, the typical kitchen counter in your home is like 361 CFUs. Your kitchen sink isn't so clean, 21,000 CFUs. The bathroom doorknob, 203 CFUs. And the typical home toilet seat, only 172 CFUs. So I guess people keep their toilet seats clean.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why the kiosks are so much worse than the toilets. The toilets actually get cleaned every once in a while, whereas the kiosks, I've never seen anyone clean them.
There you go.
People always laugh at me for either printing out my boarding pass or just using my phone for a boarding pass. Yeah, because I'm not happy touching those machines. And this just confirms my theory as to the reason why I shouldn't.
But is this really a surprise? I mean, I'm not surprised that in a super public place like an airport where there are thousands of people an hour, heading to the kiosks and things that they don't clean them. I mean, I don't know.
Once a day might be nice. I don't know.
Yeah, I wonder what some other public places, even restaurants. I mean, you see the folks cleaning the tables when a party is done, and sometimes it doesn't look very thorough. But it's a good point. I mean, there are germs everywhere. You can't expect to live in a sanitized environment, and nor should you. It's not really healthy, I don't think, in the long run. It does kind of motivate you to maybe carry some hand sanitizer with you when you're traveling.
Well, and I think that with some of this stuff, especially the check-in kiosks, the armrests, and the water fountain button, those are probably some of the only surfaces that are not automated touch at an airport nowadays, right? So I think the reason toilets aren't on here and faucets aren't on here in the airport is because most big airports have that automated. Now, whether they work or not, it's a different story. But, you know, there's very few airports do you go in and still have to turn the knob on a faucet. And I don't know the last time I've been into an airport where there's been a toilet, an actual flush that you've got to.
Yeah, usually touch. They're automated. You're right. Yeah, yeah.
So, and then even towards the water fountain, you know, you're starting to get more and more of those refill your water bottle type mechanisms.
Right. Although, Chris, I still am amazed at how many people don't wash their hands after finishing their business in the restroom.
It's shocking. That,
it's just amazing to me. And
what are you taking a survey?
Well, it's part of the book that I really want to write, which I have an outline for it, but it's the shitty airport bathroom experiences. I have dozens of stories that would just
airport bathrooms, real shitholes. No, we can't say that, can we?
No, we're not supposed to.
Speaking of surveys, there are some airports now, which I actually never touch, but there are airports now that you see little screens right outside the bathrooms that kind of say, tell us your experience, you know, and mm-hmm. they'll have a smiley face or a frowny face or whatever. And it's, I understand the airport's intentions. You know, I've been in those meetings and had those conversations, but it's one of those things where you come back and you're like, well, well-intentioned, not well executed. Mm. Yeah. So, because, you know, they're those probably have more germs than the self-check kiosk.
Yeah, they probably do.
Yeah, but you know, it's funny. I'm sorry. I just want to add one thing. You know, when the cleaners go through the airplanes every trip, I mean, I don't know. Would it be so hard if you knew that this was a germy place to take a can of Lysol and just, you know, all the armrests and on one stop during an airplane's trip during the day? I don't know. It doesn't. My guess is nobody probably knows about this.
Well, and I've actually seen, I want to say at one conference, I saw a company working on was essentially a robot that would go down the aisle. And they were using, I guess it was some type of infrared or something similar to, I think I've also seen it in aircraft laboratories, you know, as a model of what could happen. But essentially this robot will go down the aisle and using some type of heat, whatever it is, will kill germs, some type of infrared or something.
I think ultraviolet does that, maybe.
Yeah, it's UV light. Yeah, Max, when we were at Boeing, they had a bathroom of the future that was doing that.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Cleaning with ultraviolet. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I've seen a company that was using ultraviolet, not infrared. but yes, the idea is that it'll start at the beginning, you know, start at the front of the aircraft and end up in the back and one pass and it'll be clean.
Yeah, make a sweep.
Rob, I don't know if wiping down the armrest in an aircraft will make Southwest turn times. I don't know if that'll be in the.
Well, you're right. I didn't mean every single turn. I just thought that, you know, once in a while, I don't know, call me crazy. I know I shouldn't say that because you will.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I'll be happy if they just take the pretzel bag out of the seat pocket in front of me from whoever sat in the seat before I did.
Yeah.
You're supposed to take those out?
But not eat them. Next story comes from the Washington Post. Air Force One's new refrigerators will cost taxpayers $24 million. This has been kind of all over the popular press. The U.S. Air Force has awarded Boeing a contract for $23,657,671 to replace two of the 1990 vintage chiller units on Air Force One. Now, the Air Force says that they need capacity for additional cold food storage to, quote, support onboard personnel for an extended period of time without having to restock while abroad. You know, that's something that probably I never thought of, probably most people never thought of, but when Air Force One travels internationally,
they bring their own food.
Where are you going to get an Egg McMuffin on the way to Asia? Come on.
There you go. But the Air Force says that they need refrigerated storage space for about 3,000 meals, which, I don't know, David, how many people are typically on an Air Force One flight? There's a lot of people. I mean, not only the politicians, but the press. And I mean, there's a lot of people on that plane, isn't there?
There are. And what you got to keep in mind is 3,000 meals is because the aircraft is supposed to stay in the air due to a nuclear holocaust for over a week.
Right. So that's a lot of food.
It's a lot of food, but you figure you've got 100 people aboard the airplane for a week. That's not a lot of food. So it's the other part about this that the Air Force hasn't said and everything is, unfortunately, refrigerators are not environmentally sound. And one of the problems with this is they're trying to make them more environmentally friendly, which is raising the price.
Well, also, yeah, you don't go down to Sears and pick up a couple of refrigerators and say, you know, deliver them to Air Force One. I mean, these have to be custom built, custom fitted.
Exactly. Have to be able to stand radiation. And you have to be able to store lots of food when the president goes away to. There was a video about George Bush going on Air Force One, I think on Discovery, where they went to Africa, and they talk about all of the things that they packed to go, you know, and they can't trust get fuel. So they fly in C-17s with trailer trucks of gasoline for Air Force One because they can't trust the fuel. The food's the same way. I mean, you need a royal taster for the president, even if it is an egg McMuffin or Kentucky Fried Chicken. But it's still, all of that's involved, and you have to be able to feed everybody aboard the aircraft, and you have to be able to feed everybody aboard the aircraft in case of an emergency for an extended period of time. So when Air Force One takes off, it's fully loaded with food in case of an emergency.
So, David, I was wondering with this, they're replacing only two of the five. And so I'd sort of say if they replaced all five, wouldn't that make the cost per unit probably a lot less? And are they going to be doing it on both of the Air Force One aircraft or only one?
They didn't say if they're going to do it on both, but I would assume that they would be doing, since they're mirror aircraft, I would assume that they would be doing it on both aircraft. And the reason why they don't replace them all at once is you need to be able to operate the aircraft, and you need the refrigerators until you get the new ones. These are additions, not necessarily replacements.
And also, the article notes that this almost $24 million also covers cost of testing and certification by the FAA. I don't know, you roll all this together, and $24 million just doesn't really bother me a lot. I just think we have bigger problems than this $24 million. But, you know, it's this kind of stuff in the press always gets a lot of attention because it sounds like, you know,
a large number.
Yeah.
Well, part of the money they're saving is that they are not replacing the fridge in the press section. They're going to get those little styrofoam coolers that they just have to keep ice in. And
yes,
I mean, that's cutting back.
I believe that would be fake news.
No, I heard this somewhere.
This is a flying scoop? Are you saying that this is from the magazine?
There are news stories I hear. I think I saw this on a Cartoon President. Have you guys seen that show on Showtime?
No.
No.
Oh, my gosh. It is so funny. There's a cartoon version of the life of a certain president in the White House that Stephen Colbert's group put together. It's an animated half-hour show. It started last week. Anyway, enough of that.
Yeah, hysterical. I just like the quote, and boy, this will probably get cut, where Trump was quoted as saying, "I refuse to fly in the $4.2 billion plane." I only wish that were true. But that he was referring to the new ones.
Yes, so. Yes, okay.
Yeah.
All right, one more item, and this is also from the Washington Post, actually. And this is another good airline story, really.
I know. Max T took both my stories.
He did. And then he didn't even show up.
I know.
Nine airlines donate $28 million to Air and Space Museum for makeover. So these nine airlines, they've joined to make this donation to the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum to support the renovation of the America by Air exhibition. This is the downtown facility, not the Uvarhazy facility. And they're looking at a $1 billion renovation, which sounds like a pretty a pretty comprehensive renovation. And they're looking for some money from Congress, and also about $250 million from private donors. So the airlines are stepping up to make this donation here. And it says that American, Delta, and United Airlines are the lead donors. I'm not sure exactly what that means. Followed by JetBlue, Alaska, Frontier, Hawaiian, and Spirit.
They gave more than the others.
I guess that's, yeah. I guess that's what that means. The lead donors. And they also note that Southwest Airlines made a gift last year that will support a new welcome center. So not to leave out Southwest Airlines. David, are you familiar with this renovation? This sounds like a, you know, top to bottom rebuild.
It's a top to bottom rebuild. The first part of it was Milestones of Flight Gallery, which I was down for. And they are literally rebuilding from the walls out the whole DC facility. Hmm. When I was talking to General Daley about this, the answer was they didn't ever expect the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum to be either every year, either the highest attended or second highest attended museum in the world. Mm. It wore out a lot quicker than they ever expected. So they are actually going through and doing each one of the halls and rebuilding them from scratch and updating them. We've had the team on talking about the video wall that's in Milestones of Flight and the digital wall. They want to update all of the exhibits and just basically refresh the building. And the building has got a lot of wear and tear. So Milestones was the first one. Then right now the Apollo to the Moon one is being refurbished. And that is why the Apollo Columbia, the Apollo 11 command module, is out on tour in the United States to various things for the next couple of years while they refurbish that section. So if you haven't been downtown, it's a very different museum than the Udvar-Hazy Center. The yes. Downtown is smaller exhibits, various halls, and whereas Udvar-Hazy is, as they say, America's hangar, it's a giant open area. So it's a beautiful museum, but it's wear and tear, and they spent a lot of money putting into Udvar-Hazy, getting the restoration center built and the archives built and the Udvar-Hazy Center. So it's now time to go back and revisit the original, which is downtown, and they're slowly going to do that. So $28 million is a lot of money, but that's really only going for one hall, which is where the DC-3 and the 247 is, and the 747 nose, which is where the airliners are. So there are other halls, the World War II hall, World War I, the CVN-76, which is the USS National Air and Space Museum, which is the carrier display, and the various space displays. So there's a lot going on downtown, and hopefully we should probably get some gang on from the new podcast to talk about what's going on at Air and Space.
What museum does it vie with? You said most of the time it's number one.
The Louvre.
I'm sorry, the what?
The Louvre.
Oh, I thought you meant just aviation museums.
No, I mean, it's number two above everything, or number one.
That is really cool.
Yeah.
And David, you'd probably agree that this is a national treasure, right? And it should be funded. I don't see any reason why unfortunately, I see lots of reasons why Congress might balk at this, but I don't think they should. This is something that we absolutely should.
But they already pay for everybody's salaries and the running of the museum and the electricity.
Yeah.
The National Air and Space Museum is funded by Congress. All of them are federal employees.
Right. My point is they should still fund the restoration of the building as well. I'm quite happy to see the airlines chip in. Just the $600 and some million that's still needed. I just think Congress should just shut up and write a check and be done with it.
Okay. Then what do you do about, ready for this, American History Museum or Natural History Museum or the African American Museum?
They are all national treasures and need to be funded.
Are you going to raise your taxes?
Okay.
This isn't a political show.
Just tell them that America started 100 years ago and there's really nothing that happened before that. And there's think of all the money you'll save.
Yeah, but my favorite museum isn't National Air and Space Museum. Ready for this, folks? It's the American History Museum. Out of the whole Smithsonian, the one that I will always sort of want to go to is American History. I mean, natural history is really cool, too. You know, I love Air and Space, but there are other museums in the Smithsonian that are as good, if not better.
Well, I just had one point about this, and mostly that, and this may be a cynic in me, but $28 million between those eight airlines just doesn't seem like a whole lot when you consider the marketing and the branding that no doubt they will all get out of this by putting money towards it.
There's a reason why Boeing and Airbus have their names splattered all over Udvar-Hazy.
Absolutely. I just don't think, my point is, I don't think $28 million is enough between those eight. I think it's a big number, but when you're looking at the profits that they're bringing in year over year, and you're looking at the cost of other advertising dollars, like last night, the Super Bowl being, I think it was $5 million for a 30-second slot, it just doesn't. I think they could have forked out more.
Again, we're speaking with Chris Groh. He's an airport planner and co-founder at Runway.VC. Chris, again, welcome to the show. Let's talk about being an airport planner. Give us kind of a description of what that means to be an airport planner.
You mentioned earlier working with airports all across the country. That's true. Specializing in general aviation, but also non-hub and small hub airports, commercial service airports. So for those of you who may not be familiar with those terms, commercial service airports are broken down by hubs, and what that means is their classification, which is tied to the federal funding that they get. And usually it means their hub size is tied to how many passengers are coming in and out on an annual basis. As an airport planner, we like to consider ourselves as an extension of an airport staff. So for those of you who aren't super familiar with how airports are run, you'd be surprised how actual small and airport staff is when you look at how many people are coming and going out of an airport every day, much less throughout the entire year. So when we work with our clients, considering ourselves as an extension of the staff really means that we get to help the airport look beyond, you know, what 6 months looks like. So we kind of help them figure out how to plan and prepare for projects in the short term, medium term, and long term, while their core staff can focus on, you know, running the airport day to day.
It's kind of outsourcing some of the necessary activities.
Yes, outsourcing.
I mean, in a way
to look at it. Yeah, it's outsourcing, but also bringing in certain specializations, right? So the partners of the firm, the two founders of the firm, one used to work for a medium hub airport and the other one used to work for the FAA. So being able to bring those skills, especially to a small or non-hub commercial service airport and then a small general aviation airport, those skill sets and the ability to navigate the federal funding and all the red tape that comes along with that is really where we are able to kind of give that value to our clients.
So can you give us maybe some examples of some of the recent projects? Obviously, you know, not mentioning names or anything, but just what the nature of the project was like?
Yeah, so one project that I'm actually getting ready to wrap up, we're actually helping a city buy a private airport. The city had an airport or has an airport that has been privately owned for the past couple years or for the past several years. And the current owners are no longer willing or wanting to get into the airport or stay in the airport business. But the city still wants to keep the airport open. So we've been helping them through that process. Obviously, the FAA is involved and has their own requirements to justify, not only justify it, but make sure that the city is prepared to run it and operate it once they do purchase it or if they do purchase it. So we've been helping out with that kind of project, which has actually been a lot of fun. That's a pretty unique project. There are not too many airports that come for sale on a regular basis. But I mean, other projects we work with, I have a economics background, so that's where my education's in. So I tend to stick to more the financial side of things and helping airports figure out, you know, what their rates and charges should be. So a lot of airports will have, or almost every airport actually should have some type of rates and charges set in place, whether that's for hangar space, for commercial service or general aviation airports to lease terminal lease space for commercial service, figuring out how much they should charge next year and then for the next 5 years, and helping through those lease negotiations with whether it's, again, land or owners, aircraft owners at the airport or airlines, has also been something that we've been working on.
Chris, what is the sort of the landscape for airport planners? And by that I mean, are there the small number of large firms that provide most of the airport planning, or are there little independent airport planners scattered everywhere? Who is providing the service? What does that look like?
I think there it's a combination of both. I mean, we're definitely a regional firm. So, you know, we have one office in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, our quote-unquote big office. We're a small firm as is, just seven people. So our big office is three people now in New Orleans. But we've got firms our size in regional pockets around the country. Usually they could be, you know, firms our size, or they could be one person shops, just kind of making a living after they've come out of the airport, you know, the public sector, if you will, jump the fence. But then you've also got huge corporations, that are working worldwide that do airport planning. Typically those firms will also do engineering. They will either do, they'll offer both. The FAA has gotten away from airports allowing engineering firms also do planning. They're trying to move away from, you know, letting the engineers plan their next projects, basically. Tend to be a little bit of conflict of interest there. But yes, you do have, like, when you go to the conferences and that kind of stuff, you'll always see, you know, the big firms there, and they have offices across the country. And like I said, some are doing work all over the world. But every once in a while, especially if you go to the state aviation meetings, you'll tend to see the smaller firms there as well.
Rob, you must have dealt with airport planners in the past.
I have, actually, and I was going to jump in there with a question, because I have noticed some of what Chris has mentioned about engineering firms that are involved in airport planning. And it's the funniest thing, but I always thought, gee, it looks like they're making work for themselves. And everybody said, no, come on. And I don't mean that in the sense that I think these engineering firms are bad. I've known some people working for some really solid engineering firms. But as one person told me, they used this term a couple of months ago about them creating annuities for themselves, and I said, you know, it's funny. It certainly could look like that. And from a public relations standpoint, of course, it has nothing to do with the facts. It only has to do with how it looks. And if you and I think that, Chris, I bet you there are a lot of other people that may have seen it the same way.
Well, and I admittedly, you know, as an airport planner, it's not in my interest to have engineers doing airport planning. So I will admit my bias on this from the beginning. But, you know, with anything with the federal government, especially when you're dealing with federally funded entities like airports, there at least has to be some type of checks and balance, right? So engineering firms are going to have different priorities than a planning firm is. And they're even going to approach a problem differently. So when you have one firm kind of doing it all, it does skew, like you said, it does skew that opinion. And there is really is no checks and balance to that. Now, that's not in every case. Sometimes there are airports that are so small that, and they're run by a city, you know, with very little FAA funding, that they can't do, they can't afford to hire both an airport planner and an airport engineer. And so they've got a local engineer that grew up in the small town and became an engineer, and he or she's always been working at that airport. So those cases you typically see where the airport may only have one employee, and that may be the airport director, or some airports don't have any full-time employees. You know, they're run by the county sheriff as well as the, you know, whoever else. People, I don't think, really see, you know, when they see small airports and they only see private aircraft landing there, and Rob, I'm sure you can appreciate this, but usually you hear people say things like, oh, you work at private airports. Well, no, they're publicly owned, but they mostly serve private aviation. So I think that the public's opinion of airports isn't fully appreciated because they just don't understand the nuances and all the things that go behind the scenes.
Well, that's absolutely true. And of course, as I have said before on other discussions about airports typically are not very good at telling their story either. Kind of the way that business aviation has been so secretive for so long with, you know, good intentions on their part, that's part of the privacy part of business airplanes. But now that they're running short of employees, there are an awful lot of people, young people, that don't even know anything about it because they've done such a good job of keeping it quiet. And on the airport side, when the airport needs something, let's say it's a bond issue or funding for something, and they go to the local community and they go, who are you guys?
Yeah, and Max, that's one thing to answer your question earlier about, you know, what exactly an airport planner does is one of our biggest roles is helping those types of airports find funding for projects. I mean, the FAA every year does give money to airports across the country, and depending on how big you are, there is obligated money every year, you know, so it's called an entitlement that almost, I don't want to say almost every airport because that's not the case, but a large amount of the airports in this country, general aviation airports, as well as small non-hub and commercial and small hub commercial service airports, are entitled to so many thousands of dollars a year. Now, that doesn't pay for all of their projects. You know, you've got multi-million dollar projects when you've got to go out and do runway work, and those tend to have to be competed, you know, with other airports in that FAA region. So that's a big part of our job is helping a lot of these little airports find the money and then help them justify the money. Because, you know, Chicago Exec is probably going to have to compete against federal funding. Or they're not probably, they will. They'll have to compete against federal funding against O'Hare and Midway. And Chicago Exec's a huge general aviation airport in the scheme of things. They get even smaller when you go out to the DuPage counties and, you know, even further out.
But okay, so what you're saying is it's not like I grew up where when you're funding the airport, the first thing you do is you build the Colonel's gazebo and barbecue grill. And then at the end of the budget cycle, you go, oh, I have to patch the runway. So my dad's methodology wasn't really right.
Well,
it was the federal government and the Pentagon. So I guess you're.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny that you mentioned the history of that, you know, David, as you probably know, a lot of airports in this country were built because of World War II. You know, that was really the staple for a lot of airport constructions in the country. And being in South Louisiana, where a lot of our clients are, the history at some of these airports is just incredible. A few of our clients, unfortunately, the hangars themselves aren't there, but the bases are, like the base of the hangar is still there. They used to have blimp hangars that were patrolling the mouth of the Mississippi for German U-boats. And when you see the base of these hangars that were the columns to support these things, I mean, they're huge. But a lot of our clients were initially military airports that were then given over. You know, in Louisiana, we have parishes because we got to be difficult than the rest of the country. But we're given over to the local city or the local parish to run. So there's a lot of military aviation or a lot of military history at airports as well that I think often goes overlooked.
Well, speaking of hangars, we had recently received an email from one of our listeners, Carter, and he has, you know, kind of an interesting sort of dilemma, and not to necessarily solve his problem, but maybe to talk about, you know, how an airport planner might be involved in helping solve the problem. It might be interesting to just to talk about it a little bit, but Carter says at the airport that where he is, he has a business interest. He's interested in building more hangars for GA aircraft. There's a need for more hangars. They wouldn't own the land that the hangar is on because it's a county airport, but he could own the building. And he said typically the airport manager, in association with the county lawyers, set the lease rate on the property. They would also determine the term of the lease, typically around 30 years. So, you know, you own the hangar for 30 years, and then at the end of the term, the hangar would return to county ownership. Of course, that has an ROI impact if the property is developed for investment purposes. If the demand for hangars at a county GA airport is high, what determines if the county would offer incentives for investors to begin a new hangar project? So is that the kind of a question that an airport planner might try to tackle?
Yeah, I mean, I think in Carter's email, it sounds like he's describing an FBO. I mean, that's a lot of FBOs will do that, right? So they will build hangar space and lease out that space on their own dime, you know, whether it's paying a land lease or whatever the payment figure is or the payment structure is to the airport. Our job actually will start even before that. So it's required, well, it's advisable, you know, from an FAA standpoint, that every airport have what they call a set of minimum standards. And minimum standards are essentially, the FAA has guidelines, but they're set forth by the airport to ensure that no matter who is coming on to the airport, everyone gets treated equally. Now, that's not to say that, you know, if you are renting a T hanger for your Cessna versus a box hanger for your Citation, you know, those are two different class of aircraft. So there's a difference, you know, there's a different incentives or whatever the case may be for both. You know, if you're going to operate as an FBO, minimum standards are set forth by an airport to say you, in order to operate, you have to be able to do X, Y, and Z service. You know, whether that's offering fuel, whether that's providing some type of line work, you know, whatever the case may be, those are all set forth in a minimum standards. And we, as airports planners, that's something we would help our clients kind of put forth before they went out and talked to an FBO or a developer in Carter's case. So the big thing about airports with the FAA is there can't be even the slightest inclination of any type of favoritism or anything like that. Everything's got to be, you know, like I said, level playing field.
And are those minimum standards, are they airport specific?
Yeah. So like I said, the FAA has guidelines on the minimum standards, right? If you're going to write a minimum standards, they have to address X, Y, and Z. But when you get into it from an airport by airport study, that's when things will change. So there's one thing that's relevant to, you know, you hear it a lot when you go to airports, and I've heard it a lot speaking to pilots too, but you know, the old saying from a pilot standpoint is you've seen one airplane, you've seen one airplane. That is the exact same saying that every airport planner and airport director gives. You know, you see one airport, you've seen one airport, because the nuances at an airport, even if it's within the same city limits, are going to be different. They're going to serve a different role. They're going to have a different clientele. You know, they're going to serve different passengers. So it's all going to be different.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't really considered that before. So I mean, each solution is a unique solution that's specific to that airport, to those circumstances.
Yeah, and now, again, the great thing about being an airport planner is you get to kind of do a little bit at every airport, right? So while it is different, being able to borrow experiences from one airport to bring it over to another, it's not a direct copy and paste, but there definitely is like a, well, we did this over here, let's adapt it so we can do it over here.
Yeah, that must make it much more interesting. I think there are some consulting professions where, you know, it is pretty much cookie cutter. You know, each client really kind of gets the same solution, It's just a matter of, you know, replicating it across your clients, maybe with a little bit of customization, but, you know, they're oftentimes the same solution. But it sounds like when you're talking about airport planning, that's not the case at all. And so I imagine that's a more rewarding kind of a job. How did you get into airport planning? What was the path for you?
Yeah, so it's not, I can say it's not something that I thought I was going to do growing up.
Who grows up and says, I want to be an airport planner, right?
Well, and that, as I had a conversation last week about that, actually, with a colleague of mine. But for those of you who were paying attention in the beginning during my introduction, the firm that I work for, Cutchins & Grow, you know, that is, that I tell people that's not my last name. I'm not the Grow in Cutchins & Grow. It's actually my father's one of the partners. And he was the partner that I mentioned earlier that worked for a medium hub airport. So being from New Orleans, he worked at MSY throughout the 90s and would take me, you know, to work and all that kind of stuff. But I didn't grow up with the typical aviation geek story. You know, I didn't know planes. I am still learning, you know, the big planes to be able to identify them when I see them. So I didn't have that experience. But when I graduated with my MBA, I was doing a little, consulting for them. You know, they had a project that came in that they needed a little help with and a little outside help with that I was able to kind of slide in real quick. And through that process, realized that, you know, hey, airports are essentially small and depending on the size, big cities. And they've got a lot of different nuances working behind the scenes. So I kind of got more interested in it, more involved, and, you know, now I'm here today. So that may have been my father's plan all along, but yeah. I can't speak to that. But yeah, so that's how I kind of got into it. It's not, you're right though. It's not an industry that people kind of grow up saying, I want to be an airport planner. Typically most people that are in this industry kind of fall out because they wanted to be pilots. And once they got to college or however they got there, discovered airport, you know, the other side of aviation.
All right. Well, why don't we transition a little bit here because we want to get to runway.vc. But first, just talk a little bit about aviation communities. And when we say aviation communities, I mean, oh my gosh, there's just so many different kinds and types of communities, you know, ranging from flying clubs to Facebook groups to forums to Twitter to professional organizations and trade groups, residential air parks, right? There's a physical community, special interest groups. There's all these different kinds of communities. When it comes to online communities, you know, there have been some attempts in the past to try to create aviation-based communities, and some have worked and some have sort of faded away eventually. But what were you trying to accomplish, or what are you trying to accomplish with runway.vc?
So the inspiration came from runway.vc as kind of a almost out of a frustration. And this may be, admittedly, it may be a naive frustration on my part, but, you know, I am fortunate enough that because I do work for a small firm, we kind of have to do, everybody's got to do everything, right? and what that offered me at a very early part in my career is I was going to big conferences, not all of them, you know, if you wanted to, just like every other industry, you could go to every conference once a week. But I was going to a few bigger conferences throughout the year and kind of looking around the rooms and realizing, well, shoot, I'm the youngest person here. why is that the case? And realizing after talking to some of the people at bigger firms that, you know, when you're 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 years into your career, you're not on the high end of the totem pole to get to go to the conferences, right? Like they're usually sending the vice presidents or, you know, the middle management at the very least, the ones that can go out and network and bring in sales and new clients and all that kind of stuff. But what was the inverse of that was the conversations that were happening on stage and outside in the halls and so forth. And some of it was conferences and organizations just trying to bite the innovation, quote unquote, buzzwords where, you know, let's put some people up there and talk about innovative things. But realizing again that if I'm the youngest person in the room, this message should really be hitting home with me. You know, it's going to be on me that is going to have to bring forth some of these things that, you know, I'm going to have to deal with, driverless cars at airports, you know, and what that means for airport parking. I will have to deal with planning aircraft where you've got single cockpit. And I know that's a big controversy, thing, but single pilot cockpits, you know, those are the types of technology that I'm going to have to cooperate with or interact with. And everyone in the room, you will all be retired when those things come around. Yeah. But the message and the conversations that are happening aren't leaving the room because you're spending so much money to get to this conference. So we started Runway VC by just trying to get that message across. Like, let's have similar conversations that are happening and make them freely distributed. So that's where the podcast came in. The other aspect of it is the networking. And if you're not going to the conference, you know, I'm still one of those people, and I may be an outlier in people my age, but I do enjoy talking to people face to face or at least interacting with them in a real time basis. But that those connections aren't happening, you know, with young professionals. And so we tried to figure out how we can make those interactions happen at a cheaper, you know, cost, basically free. And so that's where we're taking that. We're trying to, I don't want to say too many buzzwords because I always roll my eyes when people start throwing those things around, but yeah. Democratize the conference experience, which I'm rolling my eyes when I say that.
David.
Bingo.
Yeah.
David's like the buzzword meter of the group. So Chris, how do you do that? What form does that take in Runway VC?
Yeah, so I mean, admittedly, we kind of shamelessly looked at what you all are doing. you know, they and seeing the communities that are being built around conversations, and really seeing that, well, you can't just say we're going to have a community and just throw something up. You've got to have something that kind of sparks conversation. So that's was kind of the cusp of the podcast, to kind of to be the conversation starter. Whether people disagree or agree, let's get their opinions to be shared. So that's kind of where we've been at, kind of building up that content with the podcast, as well as the name, you know, the recognition of what Runway VC is. And then moving into, you know, I think you all have done a great job with the Slack group, you know, as you said earlier, being a member in it, passive member, admittedly, but just learning all the different things from the different things that are happening in conversations that are happening there. You know, that'll be our next step. And then finally, we want to do kind of local, more local meetups, where you don't have to spend a bunch of money to go all across the country to a conference to meet people that you don't work with day to day. And also kind of bring together, which is actually the hardest part of all of this, but kind of bridge the gap in the industry. So I would love to be able to go to a conference or a meetup locally where it's not just all airport people. You know, this community is so big. And what we do as airport planners don't just impact the, you know, airport people. They impact the pilots. They impact the flight attendants and everybody else. But it's super easy to get just so myopic when you're looking at, you know, what your tasks are for an airport. So kind of bringing those people into the conversations as well.
I see some familiar faces when I look at your past podcast guests.
Yeah. Well, the other great thing about aviation is that when you look at, you know, who's got an interesting story to tell, the first initial Google searches are always going to be, you know, the people that have been around for the industry for a while and made quite a name for themselves. So, yeah, one of our very first episodes was Benay Wilson. She was great. We had a terrific conversation just about her experience in the industry and coming up. as a woman reporter and, you know, looking different than everybody in at these conferences she was going to, and what the future looks like. Again, diversity in the industry means more than just, well, we've got to hire these many women or we've got to bring in these many minority-owned businesses. It is a vast difference of opinions coming together to kind of put forth an idea. And I believe, and it may be naive again, but I believe that that's the only way the future is going to come to fruition, because you look at your day-to-day traveler and it is different than what it was 10 years ago and way different than what it was 40 years ago.
Where do you see the Runway VC site going? Are there some changes we can expect to see? You mentioned creating, I guess, a Slack team or some kind of a community like that.
We're trying to figure that out. I mean, I see it. We want to grow it to be kind of the go-to place for knowing what's coming down the pipe for aviation. I think there's a lot of different places where you can learn about the day-to-day stuff of aviation and figuring out what's happening, you know, with airline sales calls or airport enplanement numbers, et cetera. And usually those publications or those entities will sprinkle in kind of the future of aviation somewhere around the lines. But we want to be kind of the resource where you come to and here's all the different players that are going to be shaping the future, but not just on one side. So, you know, we talked about in the podcast, we had the airport director of airport operations from Lyft on talking about driverless cars. Some people are going to sit there and say, well, what does that have to do with airports? And then you realize your second biggest or your biggest non-airline revenue at an airport is usually your parking. Well, what happens to parking revenue when driverless cars are coming around? So those are the types of things that we try to attack all those different problems and have those conversations.
Do you have any kind of a sense for the sort of the demographics of the people who've been attracted to Runway VC?
So people ask me that all the time. Who is your target market, right? Usually publications that we're partnering with or something like that. And I hate to try to push that into, well, we're looking for that young professional. You know, that's the typical case, because I don't believe that, you know, you have to be under the age of 35 to be interested in the future of aviation. If you ask me who the perfect person is that I want to be involved in Runway VC, I like to tell people that it's usually someone that's just trying to either advance their career. So whether you're starting out and trying to make it to that middle level, or you're in that middle level trying to make it up to that top level, or we'll continue with the football references since it's timely, or professionals that are in the fourth quarter of their career, you know, the ones that are kind of looking at it at retirement, but don't want to get out of the industry altogether, and really have changing their focus from establishing a name for themselves to shaping, you know, what the next group of individuals in aviations are going to come around. So that's kind of that latter part. It's really easy to find people that are interested in the industry. The harder part is finding, like I said, those individuals that are really, that have all the connections, but don't want to take those connections with them once they retire and want to set the ground for further innovation down the line.
Hey, Chris, what about the other segment? Might be someone in the latter part of their career that's looking to get into aviation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said, we are not looking at just air, like a specific segment of the market. So I've had people reach out that really don't have anything to do with aviation, but see a technology or something that they're working on, see a influence in how it could influence industry. You know, I'm looking specifically at shopping malls. You know, a lot of people don't realize that airports, and I apologize to keep coming back to airports, but airports are a lot like shopping malls in a way. So there may be people that are really good at doing something in shopping malls that can track back to an airport. Blockchain, which I know is another buzzword for you, Dave, nowadays.
Yeah, we're going to have to, like, get on that one. Max and I are going to have to start talking about that, so...
Yeah, let's have another conversation offline about that, because I'm actually preparing an episode for that as well. So it'd be interesting to kind of get y'all's take on it as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That is something that's coming. I just saw either today or yesterday that Singapore Airlines is looking at using a blockchain approach to their affinity program, which is very interesting. But
yes. So to answer your question, Brian, you know, to have someone come in that has a really good expert understanding of their industry, but saying, hey, this could be applied to aviation, is absolutely somebody we want to attract.
Yeah. Okay. That rules me out, 'cause I have no expertise in anything. So I was just hoping.
Well, listen, there's a part of it where I'll give you a secret. There's a part of it where everybody who talks about the future of aviation is faking it a little bit. So,
well, yeah. Yeah.
I'll have to send Chris my resume.
All right, Chris. Of course, the website is the same as the name, runway.vc.
Yeah. Again, if you want to check out the podcast, we have a special discount for all Airplane Geeks listeners. It's free on any of their podcasts. If they go and look for it right away, we'll give all the episodes away for free. But no, if you go to the website, if you go to the website, one of the things that we're looking at, again, to tie back into this diversity, is right now the podcasts are just kind of planned by a small group of us, you know, and our viewpoints, but knowing that those viewpoints are super limited. So we're really trying to get other people's inputs, you know, whether what they want to hear, what they're curious about, or if themselves, you know, they're working on something that they want to talk about. They can go to the website, go to the podcast part of the site. I think if you go to runway.vc/podcasts as well, there's a button there that it'll take you to a form, and you can fill out the form and let us know if you've had any questions, like what the hell is blockchain or how's it going to impact aviation? Definitely would appreciate any kind of feedback on that. And if anybody's interested in just being involved, none of us, as you all know, podcasting is not paying the bills, at least not yet anyway. So, and we don't go out and have any kind of big corporate sponsorships, which is something we've strategically done because we want to be able to kind of pick our own message and our own direction right now. But if you want to be a part of it, if you want to help out, just go to the website and fill out a contact form. And in the little message, just say, hey, Chris, you know, I'm interested in being a part of Runway VC, and I'll follow back up with you. And hopefully we can connect there. And if any airport needs planning help, Cutchins and Grow is where we're at.
Get that plug in. All right. Yeah. Chris, thanks for the great conversation.
Thanks, Max.
Now we have an Across the Pond segment with all the talk about ultra long haul flights and Brian's quote short trip across the UK. Peter looks at BA, their latest change to the passenger experience in short haul flights, and then he reflects on the Qantas challenge to Airbus and Boeing on the Kangaroo route.
Hello, this is Peter Johnson. Just start off with my first story from British Airways, and this is from ITV.com. Passengers on short-haul flights with British Airways will no longer be able to recline their seats. A new fleet of aircraft based at Heathrow will be installed with the non-reclining seats. The 35 A320neos and A321neos come into use from this year, will instead have a fixed, gentle recline. It's a move already adopted by budget airlines, with EasyJet and Ryanair already using seats that cannot be adjusted. Okay, so now my first reaction was one of horror at the sheer thought of another change in the passenger experience. I flew many times on BA short haul, and when the cogs in my head went back to those days, I remembered all those who sat in front of me for a 55-minute flight reclining in their seat and me spilling coffee in my lap, or if it was a Friday, a nice glass of wine. So actually, I like this idea and I like it a lot. Anyway, on with the article. A spokesman said, "We're also completely refurbishing the cabins of all our existing A320 and A321 aircraft to improve quality and choice for our customers. We're installing at-seat power throughout the aircraft and will soon offer onboard Wi-Fi," quote unquote. The move comes after the airline reduced its in-flight meals on its short-haul flights for economy passengers. It now offers paid-for snacks from Marks & Spencer. The airline is adding an extra seat into economy class rows on some of its long-haul aircraft from this summer to enable it to offer even more lower fares. The Gatwick-based 777s will have 10 seats on each row rather than the current configuration of 9, and this will bring BA in line with other airlines like Emirates and Air New Zealand. The carrier also announced a shake-up of its catering for economy class passengers on long-haul flights, replacing the 3-course meal with a 4-course meal. What a great statement. We'll give you Wi-Fi. We'll take away a row of seats. Tit for tat. Anyway, onwards with my next thoughts. As you know, the Royal Aeronautical Society is an extended partner. They run lectures all around the world, and these can be fascinating insights into the sector, with everything from aerospace medical issues to ATC to aircraft to aerospace innovation. But one lecture caught my eye last year, and that was with the Qantas chief exec, Alan Joyce. Steve Fisher's mate, you know the guy. You see, Qantas have set Boeing and Airbus a challenge to fly direct to London on the aptly named Kangaroo route. Let me let Mr. Joyce introduce the concept.
And very properly, what's going to happen next March with the first direct flight between Australia and Europe when we start Perth to London. It'll be 17 hours non-stop. It'll be done with the most sophisticated navigation system. And it is a partnership between a whole series of different agencies and different individuals to make it happen. The prime partnership is with Boeing to produce an aircraft that had the range to be able to do that flight. But we're also teamed up with the University of Sydney and the Charles Perkins Institute to actually redefine what long-haul travel is all about. And they're working with us on a major health study to figure out how we reduce the impact of jet lag and super long-haul flying. That's resulting in light scientists looking at the lighting on board the aircraft, food scientists working with Neil Perry, our chef, to redesign the menus to actually have food with different spices that can reset the circadian rhythms. And we've worked on every little inch of managing the weight on that aircraft.
So they want to fly Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane to London.
As a nod to the secret order of the double sunrise, Qantas has issued a challenge to both Boeing and Airbus to produce an aircraft by 2022 that can fly direct from Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane to London.
And they want to press Airbus with the A350 and Boeing with the 777X with getting an aircraft that can do this.
We've gotten a great reaction from both manufacturers. Actually, just before I came here, I had a note from Tom Enders, the CEO of Airbus, saying that our team had gone to Toulouse, talked to Airbus about their aircraft, the 350, and he was very impressed with our approach. Now, to be clear, this challenge is to fly the route with full passengers and payload. The aircraft can do it today, both the 777 and the 350, but we believe it can't do it with full payload. We do believe that more work is needed on both aircraft to get it there. Boeing similarly, and when we took delivery of the 787, Kevin McAllister gave a speech where he said that Boeing is up for this challenge.
So they're working on better meals, better lighting, better atmosphere. Need I go on? So, with all this talk of long flights, pole to pole, and Brian to Singapore for a 3-hour layover. Oh, Brian, did you actually say last week you took the short flight to London? Don't you live West Coast? Now, from memory, that's a good 9 to 10 hours eastbound and 10 to 11 hours westbound. See, I used to do it quite regularly on business, and I will say with loading and disembarkation,
That's a 12-hour bum-on-the-seat flight. And you say short? Okay. Back to my point. I love aeroplanes. That goes without saying. I love flying too. But, and here it is, these airlines are tricking us into thinking they're doing great by the passengers with fancy food, lighting, and on and on and on. What we actually want is a little bit of extra space so that we don't have to cramp ourselves into an aircraft for 12 hours. God help me, 17 hours to Perth. Sorry, no. So BA, ramming in another row to the 777 negates all of that. And Qantas, well, I know the airline is turned around, but really, do you honestly think we're going to feel refreshed and invigorated because of the lime and herb concoctions in our meals? No, we're still going to be feeling unable to walk and function unless you give us more legroom, space room and elbow room. For goodness sake, how did you do it, Brian? 17 hours. I know it's sacrilege to denigrate the airlines on an aviation program, but age is one thing that it's brought me. And it's now I'm part of the majority of people who fly who are no longer classed as youngsters. I can't do it. Even my 27-year-old who flies all around the world is complaining about the space. So David, Rob, over to you. Would you last 17 hours in economy in one of these ultra-long-haul flights? Me? I'd be ready to fight anyone to get out of there after being cooped up like a trussed chicken for what in reality would be 18 or 19 hours. That's me, rant over. It's Old Pops Johnson reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
All right, thanks, Peter. That was a good one.
Yeah, good one, Peter. I'm not a medical professional, and I certainly don't condone the use of any particular thing, but gosh, Ambien certainly made the trip tolerable for me. I really didn't mind it. I really didn't.
That's just like drugging yourself, though, right? I mean, you pass out? Is that what Ambien does?
Yeah, it's a sleep aid. So, yeah, or sleeping pill. Yeah. So when the reason why I called it a short trip to London, because compared to flying to Singapore for, I think the flight we had tailwind, so it was 15 hours instead of the scheduled 17, whatever. Yeah, it was only 10 to England, so that was easy.
Yeah.
But yeah, it go on board, fall asleep, wake up, you're there, good to go.
Well, all of my trans-Pacific flights were always in business class. In coach, I wouldn't have done it. I don't see how you can survive a flight that long in a small coach class seat, whether you're asleep or awake. I don't know. Space counts for a lot, I think. All right, let's see. I'll mention just real quickly, we have a new episode of the PaxX podcast out, episode 54. We, being Mary Kirby and I, talked with Mark Naylor. He's head of compliance for Gate Gourmet in Oceania. Gate Gourmet, of course, they're the world's largest provider of airline catering and onboard products and services. So take a look at that episode if you like. That's paxxpodcast.com. It's episode 54. Brian, what have you been up to lately? Anything interesting?
Oh, this weekend I went out to the airport at Chino to the Planes of Fame Museum, and they had a wonderful presentation. They had Colonel Edward, and I'm going to mess up his last name, Fleichinger. He's a retired colonel from the U.S. Air Force, and he flew C-47s during World War II. And he got to tell his story about flying between Saipan and Iwo Jima and doing low-level runs on the runway where the Japanese were on one side and the Americans were on the other side of the runway. And he had to do three runs to empty the cargo out of his C-47. And he was just a sweet old guy. And when I say old, I believe he was 97 years old. And his stories were just great. And I think part of the greatest generation and listening to them recount their stories is absolutely fantastic. But he had a surprise waiting for him. The folks at Planes of Fame actually have a C-47, and he had said years ago that one of his last wishes was to fly in a C-47, and they granted his wish.
Nice.
And he broke down and cried.
Oh.
It was so incredibly special.
Yeah, yeah. That's, yeah, very emotional.
Yeah, so those guys, if anyone's in the Southern California area or if you want to make a trip to Southern California, definitely get out to the Planes of Fame. They have so many beautifully restored aircraft, and they just do a great job. And they have the first Saturday of every month, they focus on a different plane, and the museum's just fantastic and highly, highly recommend it.
Nice. All right, let's get on to a little bit of listener mail. Our main man, Micah, sent us a story from the Press Herald up in Maine. Snowies and their admirers causing problems at Portland Jetport. Snowies, huh? Well, the Snowies are snowy owls. And apparently a bunch of them have taken up residency at Portland International Jetport for the winter. It seems that they've had a little bit of a population explosion of these owls, and there's more of them, and their range is extending, I guess probably because there's so many of them. They fly south for the winter, but they're taking up residence around the Portland Jetport, and which is a nice thing, except that a whole bunch of birders or bird spotters are showing up. And they're also worried that the owls may get spooked by all the people looking at all the owls and scare them into the paths of planes. And they've actually captured some and moved them away from the Jetport. But it's sort of an ongoing problem. These owls are really beautiful. I mean, I can really understand why people would want to come and look at the owls, but it's kind of a different part of spotting. I don't know. I've never really been a plane spotter. I guess have any of you guys kind of gotten into that, or just only casually?
For me, I'd say it's only casually. I mean, I was at an event a couple of weeks ago out west of O'Hare. On the way back, I had to go past the south side, and there was a good spot. You know, I just pulled over and just watched all the airplanes coming off of, I can't remember which runway it is now. It used to be easy to tell, but now there are six of them. But it was kind of cool just to watch what was happening. But, you know, again, I don't do it very often because at least around O'Hare, there really isn't a whole lot of great spots to sit.
You mean how I used to walk down to the end of the runway and watch the airplanes take off?
It's not so easy anymore.
No. I actually have to drive to the airport at this point.
And I think that, and maybe Chris, you could confirm or deny this, but it seems like many airports no longer have observation decks, you know, where you can get up outside out on the observation deck and just sit out there and watch the planes come and go.
Yeah, I haven't seen too many airports building, especially with the several that are building new terminals and that kind of stuff. I don't see a lot of them planning observation decks, which is a real shame.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I didn't, like I said earlier, I didn't grow up in those plane spotting outings. I'm the same way. I do it casually. In fact, I think the most plane spotting that I do is if I ever have to stay at the Grand Hyatt at DFW on top of Terminal D. That's usually the best way for me to plane spot, from just by opening in the window. I don't see too many observation decks. And like I said, some of these communities with plane spotters, I mean, I'm in one on Facebook, and the analysis that they do on statistics at their airports is insane.
Yeah.
I just want to, like, in fact, you know, I pull out a lot of stuff from just being in these things passively, and use them when I go to conferences. And I just want to tell them, hey, y'all know you can make money doing this stuff, right? It just doesn't have to be.
I
think in terms of the owls, you know, any kind of big bird population in an airport's always going to be an issue. It sounds like this airport needs another Piper the kind of dog that they had up in Traverse City that just passed away.
Or deer.
Oh, deer is a huge, especially our, a lot of our airports have big problems with deer.
We had it. We had a couple of deer take out a C-130 once at the base.
Wow.
Deer and coyote are also a big problem at airports down south, especially because during the day they like to lay out in the sun and get a lot of heat. Well, it, you know, they tend to find the big numbers on the runway as a nice spot just to lay. And they're smart, so getting rid of them is not an easy thing to do.
And deer can do, can jump an 8-foot fence from a standing start.
Yeah.
They don't even, they just sort of hop over it. It's kind of amazing.
All right. Well, we heard from our friend David, a different David. We were talking about how you can sometimes get away with things you shouldn't get away with. Well, David has a story. He says, back in the mid-80s, I heard about a skydiving operation on an Army post in Alabama that only charged $1 per jump, as they used an Army UH-1 Huey with Army pilots hauling skydivers to build some stick time. Regular civilian drop zones typically charged $1 per 1,000 feet. 10 grand equaled 10 bucks. The catch was one had to be active duty to take advantage of the recreational jumping on this particular Army post. So David says, I posed as a full-time member of the Georgia National Guard stationed at Dobbins Air Force Base in Marietta, Georgia, who worked on the F-105G Thunder Chief, which is what the Georgia Air National Guard flew at the time. Although I was medically unable to serve in the military, I was a junior ROTC and the Civil Air Patrol while in high school and knew enough military stuff to get by. Long story short, I made 11 jumps from 10,000 feet from UH-1s for 11 bucks. I pretended to have left my ID in my hotel room, and when they said no more jumping until I went and got it, I left and didn't go back. I highly doubt someone could get away with this with the current security stuff in effect. So, oh, I love that story. David also says something else I was wondering about. Is there any way y'all could solicit stories from Cold War and Vietnam aircrew to tell us about what it was like to operate and fly those now mostly extinct aircraft? Won't be long before the Vietnam generation begins to rapidly die off, and they seem pretty closed-mouthed about their experiences. So, yeah, if any of you listening have some stories from, well, the Cold War or Vietnam, some aircrew stories, you know, let us know, contact us, and let's see if we can capture some of those stories. And then finally, we got an email from Ann McNamara, and she wrote us, she said, on behalf of Mark Bryan. He's a co-founder of NCTAR, which is New Century Transportation and Aerospace Research. And they've been doing some work on the sonic boom problem, which we talked about last week. And there's an article from The Economist that we'll put a link to in the show notes that kind of describes what's going on here. Basically, they look at placing the engines forward, well forward of the leading edge of the wing. And the idea is that would send the shock waves up instead of downward. And they've got some other thoughts on how they can manage those shockwaves so they don't reach the ground. It's an interesting topic. I don't know to what degree this has been vetted as something that might be effective at reducing or even eliminating sonic booms. But we'll have that article link in the show notes, and you can take a look at that. All right. Well, with that, we want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Again, our guest was Chris Groh. Chris, thanks so much for the conversation. Tell everybody where they can find, well, Runway VC and Cutchins and Groh.
Yeah. So Runway VC, you can check out our website, like you mentioned earlier, just runway.vc. Also on Twitter at Runway VC. You can find Cutchins and Grow at our website at Cutchins-grow.com. Cutchins is pretty much spelt like it sounds, K-U-T-C-H-I-N-S, and Grow is G-R-O-H.com. You can also find me on Twitter at Chris Grow.
All right, very good. You can visit airplanegeeks.com if you'd like to see how to contact us, how to subscribe to the podcast, learn more about us, see the show notes. So we always have pretty extensive show notes. If you want to go straight to those, they're at airplanegeeks.com/489. Now let's tell folks where they can find us online. And Rob, Mark, let's start with you.
Well, any place that has Jetwine in the name or something that has Flying Magazine in the name, and who knows where in between.
Good. And David Vanderhoof, where do we find you?
Well, Thursday I'll be probably on Broad Street in Philadelphia.
yeah.
But you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com. And, of course, you can find me on Thursday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, on the UAV Digest. You can find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, on the UAV Digest.
Yeah, boy, I thought you were going to pull up my workload a day there.
Sorry about that, boss.
No worries. And Brian Coleman, how do we get in touch with you?
Yeah, if anyone is or knows of anyone with a story, let me know by sending me an email at brian@airplanegeeks.com, and we could talk about possibly getting you on the show.
And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com, also at PaxXPodcast.com with Mary Kirby. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at BrotherLoveRocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. You can visit BrunoMassone.com and find more of his compositions that merge aviation sounds with music. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Good night, everybody.
Keep the blue side up, and thanks for listening. We'll be right back.